Do you know someone with mild to moderate Alzheimer's? A clinical drug is being conducted to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of a study drug for the treatment of symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Qualified participants must be 55 to 85 years old and have a support person to attend study visits. Qualified participants receive study-related medical care, memory testing, and routine lab work. Details at 215-884-1700. 215-884-1700. The Clinical Trial Center supports WHYY.
This week's NAACP convention in Philadelphia has been attracting presidential visitors. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Yesterday, President Barack Obama addressed the civil rights group about his agenda to reform mandatory sentencing laws. And today, former President Bill Clinton offered a mea culpa, saying he made a mistake while in office by lengthening sentences for some nonviolent offenders, especially those who only had a relationship with drug dealers.
That was overdone. We were wrong about that. That percentage of it, we were wrong about. So the good news is, we had the biggest drop in crime in history and the first 8-year decline in crime in history. The bad news is we had a lot of people who were essentially locked up who were minor actors for way too long.
Clinton also called on Americans to work with politicians to resolve differences and improve police-community relations. As the convention winds down, the 106-year-old civil rights organization faces challenges to remain relevant. Black Lives Matter, which started as a hashtag, became an international rallying cry. It's energized young activists in a way that many don't think they need established civil rights groups. To address those concerns, the NAACP has been actively cultivating a new generation. WHYY's Jeanette Woods met some of them at the conference.
The officers of the NAACP Columbus, Georgia Youth Council are taking a break between events. They look dapper in blue sweater vests, crisp white shirts, and blue and gold ties. Forche Anthony is vice president of the branch and already a veteran NAACP member.
I was actually 6 years old when I joined, and now I'm 14, about to be 15.
They're smart, focused, and on message, and they represent the new breed of NAACP leadership.
When I was younger, I didn't understand what we were going through. Now that I'm older and I can get a clear visualization on what's going on, I know and understand what I'm fighting for.
The cases of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tanisha Anderson, and other victims of police violence have heightened racial tensions, re-energized old-school civil rights activists, and spawned a legion of new activists who mobilized through social media. They're free to be outspoken and protest openly. They don't need the safety and support of being affiliated with or sanctioned by a national organization.
Those who grew up in the NAACP, they find it very relevant. But outside of the NAACP family, broadly defined, not so much.
Philadelphian Faye Anderson is founder of Tracking Change, an online platform that promotes transparency and accountability through data. She's not a member of the NAACP and says that their use of corporate sponsorship compromises their effectiveness. But Anderson feels that as protest shifts into the digital realm, it's difficult for all of the legacy civil rights organizations, and wooing young people is key to survival.
For the NAACP to stay relevant, they need the energy of young people.
This year's convention featured plenty of programming, lunches, and workshops geared specifically to young organizers. Will Roberts is the treasurer of the Columbus, Georgia Youth Council. He feels a common purpose with independent activists, but he wants them to know the NAACP is not old-fashioned.
We are old, we've been around for a while, but at the same time we're adaptable.
And Roberts has a message for other young protesters.
I can understand where they're coming from. Like those people who stand on the side of the street, they can hold up signs and spread the word. But if you're standing with thousands of others in the NAACP and trying to spread the word, there's strength in numbers.
Jeanette Woods, WHYY News.
Driving from New Jersey to Philadelphia will now cost a bit less each month for some commuters. WHYY's Aaron Mazzell reports a discount for some Delaware River bridges is coming back.
It costs $5 every time you cross into Pennsylvania on the Ben Franklin, Commodore Barry, Walt Whitman, or Betsy Ross bridges. Under a resolution passed by the Delaware River Port Authority, EasyPass commuters will get an $18 account credit if they make 18 or more round-trip bridge crossings during a given month. Enrollment in the program is free and automatic, says DRPA Commissioner Eugene DePasquale.
It's a little bit of a break, and at a time when the hardworking men and women of this region need it.
An estimated 30,000 drivers are eligible for these so-called commuter credits. That's expected to cut toll revenue by at least $6.4 million a year. The DRPA will reevaluate the program after 3 years. Riders on the DRPA's PATCO High Speed Line will not get a similar discount. DRPA President John Hansen says the authority is instead focusing on improving service.
Around $200 million in the new car program, more than $100 million in the Benjamin Franklin Track Rehab Program. So these are big investments, some of the biggest capital investments DRPA has ever made.
Initially, the discount will only go to drivers who signed up for EasyPass in New Jersey. A DRPA spokesperson says efforts are underway to also extend it to those who got EasyPass tags from Pennsylvania. The commuter credit program was phased out in 2011 because of budgetary woes. It's expected to be up and running in 3 months. I'm Aaron Mosell, WHYY News.
The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is asking the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to consider how citizens can judge how honest or effective public officials are if they quickly destroy electronic records of what they do. The newspaper wants deleted government emails preserved longer than the 5 days as called for under current policy. WHYY's Todd Bookman reports that rules for keeping emails vary widely in our region and could be changing.
The lawsuit stems from an open records request made by the Post-Gazette to the Pennsylvania Department of Education. The newspaper wanted information on a former special advisor with a six-figure salary. What it got back was only a handful of emails. The rest, it turned out, had been deleted by the special advisor.
Well, we believe in openness. We believe that people who do the people's work, that work should be subject to the scrutiny of the people who pay their salaries.
This is Post-Gazette executive editor David Shribman. He's asked the courts to impose a 2-year hold on all electronic records. While there's a long, colorful list of scandals exposed through the release of emails, he says the public's right to know isn't just about uncovering the next Bridgegate or Benghazi.
One doesn't need to find something illegal or unethical in emails to realize that what's in those emails is itself the public's business.
Under Pennsylvania's current system, it's up to each employee to determine what's worth keeping. So if an email is of value to the public record, it is supposed to be retained. Or if it's of little worth, click delete, and the thing is gone permanently after 5 days. The net effect is that each public employee is the gatekeeper of transparent government. Terry Mutchler is a lawyer and former director of Pennsylvania's Open Records Office. She says while the Commonwealth's right to know law is fairly modern, a separate code that covers document retention is, well,
it was written in 1929. And if you take a snapshot of 1929, you're dealing with, like, you know, Al Capone in Chicago, when blackberries were still fruit on a vine and not the technology-driven place that we are today.
Neighboring states have taken different approaches to email transparency. In New York, for instance, Governor Andrew Cuomo was recently forced to rescind a 90-day deletion policy and is writing new rules. In New Jersey, all emails are held for 7 years, with some subject to longer hold times. In Delaware, it's 1 year, even if the employee never clicks delete. Michael Honicki with the First State's Department of Technology and Innovation says it's a balancing act.
Cost is always a factor, and email can take a considerable amount of storage to retain for a long period of time.
City of Philadelphia has a 50-day retention policy for all emails. It cites cost as the main factor. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf's administration isn't commenting on whether its 5-day rule may change. Eric Arneson, the current director of the state's Office of Open Records, says he's seen plenty of information requests denied due to deleted emails. But he adds it's unrealistic to expect these things to be saved forever.
That's an untenable position. At the same time, having no email ever saved for, you know, more than a minute or two at the other extreme, that's untenable as well. The answer is obviously somewhere in the middle.
Pennsylvania's 80,000 state employees reportedly send and receive 5 million emails per week. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette wants more of those records to hang around for longer. Though a lower court threw out the paper's case, it's preparing an appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, President Barack Obama has signed an executive order creating an emergency board to investigate the dispute between New Jersey Transit and its labor unions. Talks between the transit agency and unions broke down last month. The negotiations include all 17 of NJ Transit's unions representing more than 4,000 workers. The unions have been working without a contract for 4 years. NJ Transit Executive Director Ronnie Hakim said today that the agency requested the intervention and is hopeful it will help reach a decision. Pennsylvania prison officials are scheduling 3 executions over the next 2 months, though it's unlikely they'll proceed because of Governor Tom Wolf's capital punishment moratorium. There's another execution barrier. The prison system does not currently have the mixture of drugs required by law. Wolf has already issued 3 reprieves for other death row inmates and says he'll continue to issue them at least until he gets an overdue legislative study on the death penalty. The state Supreme Court is reviewing the governor's policy. 80 degrees, gray skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. The chance of showers persists into this evening and then gradual clearing overnight, falling back to 66 degrees. Tomorrow, enjoy a sunny day. Thursday's high in the low 80s. Still ahead, the results are in from the inaugural Pennsylvania Core Standards Test, and the scores are low.
You know, you're going to see huge outcry, and I can certainly envision a scenario where teachers are very unjustly attacked for this process when the target's been moved and the bar's been raised.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Abington Hospital Jefferson Health supports WHYY. Abington Hospital has been recognized as a fully accredited chest pain center by the Society of Cardiovascular Patient Care. The specialized physicians at their Heart and Vascular Institute help patients who arrive with symptoms of a heart attack, quickly evaluating patients experiencing these symptoms and offering the best available treatment options. If you have chest pain, their team is dedicated to helping you continue to enjoy life. Learn more at jefferson.edu/abington.
Interesting is just a word. So when we say WHYY is where you get more interesting, what are we actually offering you? For us, interestingness comes from the things that make public radio unique. News and information that stimulate and challenge. Context, conversations, insights, revelations that make you feel mentally alive, connected to your community. You like knowing more. You want answers. You choose radio with substance. WHYY. Get more interesting.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The number of Pennsylvania students who earn proficient scores on state standardized tests this year has dropped precipitously compared with 2014. The latest slip marks 4 straight years of testing declines. As WHYY's Kevin McCory reports, the state says there's a simple explanation for the drop.
The numbers, which are still preliminary, aren't pretty. Proficiency rates in grades 3 through 8 dropped on average by about 35 percentage points in math and 9.5 percentage points in English. The Pennsylvania Department of Education says scores are down because the tests became substantially more rigorous.
This is a totally new assessment for Pennsylvania. And therefore, you know, we have a brand new baseline. So we really can't compare it to anything.
David Volkman is the department's executive deputy secretary. He says this past school year was the first in which every test question aligned to the Pennsylvania Core standards, which are similar but not identical to the Common Core. Volkman describes a recent conversation he had about this with a group of students.
And I said, you can't be defeated about this because I said, you have to realize it was a whole new set of questions, a whole new level of expectations for you. But I guarantee you this. If you're in third grade this year, by the time you're in fifth grade, you are going to be doing so much better because you are going to be up to par. This is like a runway.
This isn't the first time Pennsylvanians have been asked to accept a new baseline for test scores. In October, under then-Governor Tom Corbett, a Department of Ed spokesman described last year's scores as the new baseline. In 2012, Corbett's then-Education Secretary said that that year's results were the first Pennsylvanians could trust after years of systemic cheating. Even if this is now the new baseline for students, dealing with this test score drop is messy. Despite saying it isn't useful to compare this year's scores with past results, the Department of Ed now says those comparisons will be inherent in the state's evaluation of schools and teachers. The Pennsylvania State Educators Association, the state's largest teachers union, says that will undoubtedly feed misperception. Chris Clayton is the assistant director for education services.
You're going to see huge outcry, and I can certainly envision a scenario where teachers are very unjustly attacked for this process when the target's been moved and the bar's been raised, all in combination with funding cuts.
Adam Schott is the former executive director of the State Board of Education. He now acts as policy director at Research for Action. In this conversation, he says appreciating nuance is everything.
There have been very concerted efforts to undermine confidence in public schools, specifically efforts that use standardized test results to label schools as failing. I think we all need to be more mindful to police that kind of rhetoric.
The Department of Education expects scores to rise as classrooms adjust to tougher standards. Meanwhile, the budget debate on just how many resources those classrooms will have has come to a standstill in Harrisburg. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCrory.
The Philadelphia Water Department enacted changes this month intended to cut down on local flooding, encourage the use of green infrastructure, and bolster the health of the Schuylkill, Delaware, Wissahickon, and all water systems flowing in the city. Let's look at new regulations enacted to comply with the Clean Water Act with Philadelphia Water Department engineer Victoria Linoci and Philadelphia Water Department city planner Jeremy Chadwick. Victoria, Jeremy, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
So let's first talk about cutting down on local flooding. I'm sure that's of primary concern to residents who are affected. Let's listen to one disgruntled South Philadelphia resident, Kate Houston.
We get a huge gush of stormwater that comes in the front drain in everyone's basements. And that can leave, you know, anywhere between 3 inches of combined sewer or, you know, maybe just rush in and rush right out.
Ugh, will these new regulations eliminate that potential, or is it at best hoping to mitigate it somewhat?
I think the new regulations are going to mitigate it. The regulations regulate development citywide, and what that does is make improvements citywide. So where a single resident might not see the immediate change, the improvements are being made to the system itself citywide.
Vicki, what's the general strategy on how to better manage water runoff?
So what we've done with this reg update is get a little bit more management out of every development site. So each development site is going to be managing more water on site. They'll be slowing the rate at which the water releases back to our system. And they're also going to be cleaning more of the dirtiest water that's running off their site. So water that's laden with high sediment, high pollutants will get cleaner as a result of these requirements.
And Jeremy, do these regulations apply only to new developments or retroactive?
It's new development and redevelopment. So every time a parcel in the city gets built on, it's our opportunity to mitigate how that runoff leaves the site. So these regulations are applicable towards a site being redeveloped or new developed.
And does that apply to both residential and business concerns?
Yeah, it's really about just development when the site's turning over, if it's a row homes being developed or if it's a shopping center being developed.
Let's go through the course of runoff leaving the site. What typically happens now?
Typically, right now, it's just hard connected into our sewer system. So as soon as the rain hits the ground or our rooftop, it's going directly into our system, which our infrastructure, it's old. It has a capacity, a limited amount of runoff it can handle. And when too much runoff goes in, that's when you have the issues of backups and the system not being able to hold as much runoff as that's generated.
But the new changes certainly can't cure the old infrastructure.
Right, but it can start chipping away at the capacity of the overall system, where each site that's being redeveloped has to manage that stormwater on that particular site. So it's holding back the runoff on site until the system can handle it when the rainstorm is less intense.
Speak to the aspect of working to encourage the use of green infrastructure.
What we've seen at the department is that green infrastructure can have different benefits beyond just the actual performance that they do for stormwater management itself. And they obviously have social and other benefits that can be seen at the surface in neighborhoods when we're using these greening systems, vegetated systems, to manage the water on site. So not only does the department see the benefit of the performance of the systems, but it's very visible and can, you know, bring greening to a neighborhood.
In the broader sense, can you give a grade in 2015 to the health of our rivers, Schuylkill, Delaware, Wissahickon, et cetera, and what these regulations might do to raise that grade a bit?
Yeah, I would say right now, I mean, arbitrarily, it's probably around a B. I mean, where it's been in the past, I mean, you look back at the 70s and the 60s.
Mom told me don't even stick a toe in the water. Yeah,
I mean, the term Schuylkill punch, I mean, that we're not in that position anymore. There's been huge strides to improve the water quality in Philadelphia. And this is just taking it even further, where these are federal mandates that the water department's taking a proactive initiative on to really tackle it head on. And there's multiple ways to manage stormwater. And as Vicky mentioned, we're taking the green approach, the surface approach, that we think is better for the communities and our bottom line. It's going to be a wiser investment of our capital assets.
Lastly, though, it's not on topic right here for these regulations. Let me ask on behalf of listeners, what grade would you give to Philadelphia's drinking water?
I give it an A+. You know, you hear some of these results that we're testing for some of these things and we're finding some things in the water, the pharmaceutical story a couple of years ago. That's because we're finding it and we're addressing it. Where not every municipality has the same type of water quality monitoring that we do. So when you hear about those things in the news, it's a good thing because it means we're on top of it and we're taking care of it.
Whereas in other parts of the country, perhaps ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, to each their own, I guess.
Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Victoria Linocci is an engineer with the Philadelphia Water Department. Jeremy Chadwick is Philadelphia Water Department city planner. I'm only happy when it rains. Finally this evening, an upcoming local tennis tournament will say goodbye to ball girls and boys during halftime and say hello to ball dogs. During the July 17th and 20th matches at Villanova University between the Philadelphia Freedoms and the Washington Castles, Cal and Teddy from Canine Partners for Life, a service dog organization, will take the field as ball dogs. Kids will be given a chance to ask representatives from Canine Partners for Life questions about service dogs. The Philadelphia Animal Welfare Society, or PAWS, will also be in attendance with dogs for fans to meet and mingle with. Though these canine catchers are not a new phenomenon in our area, the Trenton Thunder minor league baseball team had bat dogs for 13 years now, with three generations that started with their original dog, Chase. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.